time for The Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com. This is Paul Daly here with my wife, Caroline.
Hi, guys.
And we're here to discuss the fourth episode of HBO's first season of The Leftovers. This one is called BJ and the AC. Rather than explain the first shot up to about the 20th shot to try to describe what's going on, I think, why don't we just say that we are watching the inimmaculate conception of Mapleton's Christmas time Jesus at the factory.
Where, little baby Jesus.
Yes. He is being born out of
just plastic and
goo turned into a savior.
And in the background is playing this kind of sad kind of tune that's like all born tired. I'm not the one.
And it is slow paced, and it's
methodical.
It's a nice match between what we're hearing and what we're seeing. Nothing is in a hurry about either thing. And the baby winds up in the city of Mapleton's manger, where we're allowed to see some time pass with a nice day-night kind of montage where we get to see familiar GR watchers and a neighborhood dog and a disheveled Santa kind of go streaking by during that montage. And the camera comes back in close to the manger where we see in the cradle that sometime in those intervening days, baby Jesus has been absconded with into the night or day. We're not sure which.
This song was an awesome moment of realizing, you know, they're singing, I'm not the one. And then obviously, you know, that is a good opposite line to what we know for He is the One, Lord Jesus Christ. So for me, that as soon as I was listening, this wasn't one of those ones where you had to try to really pick your brain as to what are they trying to tell us. It was like they're playing I'm not the one. They're showing you this really manufactured version of Jesus. And then, you know, they're showing you that this baby doll is supposed to represent Jesus. And I don't know, it's an interesting little mix there.
With the Jesus missing, we go to the introduction scene. And when the introduction is over, we are with Kevin and Patty in Kevin's office at the police station.
Kevin's so sassy. I like that he's like, obviously he's asked Patty to come in and he's a... I like how he's like, do you want a drink, water, coffee, Drano?
That's
so nasty.
Kevin at his most humorous.
Right? I love that dry sarcasm. Love it, love it.
Patty has no response, not even a shift in her facial expression.
No, actually, like when he says Drano, she actually kind of like does this move with her lips. So he kind of does get her goat a little. I love that.
He is pleading with Patty. He doesn't want any trouble for an upcoming holiday benefit dance, and he's asking her to keep the guilty remnant away from the event. He says to her, he says a lot of other things, but the punchline is, people want to spend time with their families.
Patty's so gross. She like instantly, you know, makes his face and gets out her little notepad and writes, there is no family. I feel like to anybody, but especially a family man like Kevin, that's like such a nasty comment.
And as sort of an exclamation mark to her statement there, she turns around, finds on his big board of GR members a picture of Lori and takes it down and kind of tosses it at him.
Yeah, that's her retort to Kevin asking, what does this possibly mean, this there is no family? And I mean, it is a punch in the gut because, I mean, basically he's pretty quick to say, you know, kind of defend family. And then so for her to just so easily be able to find an example of, yeah, well, you thought this chick was in your family, not so much.
So she takes off and Kevin's right-hand man, Dennis, comes in and they discuss how it is their certainty that the GR is definitely showing up at the dance and that to bring up new business, it's come to Dennis's attention that the baby Jesus is missing from the city manger.
And in that conversation, we totally couldn't figure out that obviously he was trying to bait Patty a little bit. Like he's like, oh yeah, they're coming. Like he was kind of like totally cool with that. The next scene, he's trying to make a call to Tommy, and the message says no longer in service and no new phone number. And again, I think that just completely underlines Patty's last message of there is no family. He's trying desperately to have a little, just some little bit of reinforcement that, like, yes, he does have family in here. Tommy's, of course, not only just not answering, but now the phone's not even in service.
So the scene shifts now to Tommy and Christine, and we get a subtitle letting us know that we're seeing them in Amarillo, Texas.
So, at first we were thinking maybe they were in like a bus station or something, but the more we watched, it looked like maybe they were in some sort of like youth hostel-ish something.
A shelter?
Something. It kind of almost looked like a school. Yeah, like a rec center. It does kind of look like that. Some sort of thing. And there's a poster on the wall and stuff about how we remember. But people are just kind of milling around, sort of, you know, drinking like coffee, something that would be given out free, and just sort of like, you know, visiting, I guess, with one another.
And
very
things get real when a foreigner can't figure out exactly where he's from, because he speaks with a British accent, but then he throws out little other bits that if you turn on the subtitles to say speaking in German. But what's significant about him, other than his menacing nature, is that besides the T-shirt he decided to put on, he's not wearing anything else.
Totally disarming there to see this man in all his glory, because he walks over and he's yelling at Christine. He's saying,
"Why are you in my dream?"
And you walk over the dead and they're all in white. And, you know, he goes ahead and starts jumping onto Christine and pushing her and choking her and everything. So the fact that he's pantsless gets all together much more in your face when him and Tommy start kind of scuffling, rolling around, and Tommy's trying to push him and get him off Christine. And man, the fact that they opted, I have this vision in my head that the actor came on set and they were like, yeah, go ahead and do the scene. And he was like fully clothed. And then they're like, you know what? Let's try this shot with your pants off. And he was like, what? Because this was one of those things where you're like, oh my God, that just took a scene that was kind of like not that exciting. Because I mean, really, they were just a little tussling. It wasn't like some big, bad fight scene. Into like this, like, oh my God, I just need to like close my eyes, because we are seeing the undercarriage of this man kind of rolling all around with Tommy. So it made for sort of some comic relief that he was pantsless, because it just made him come off crazy, ridiculous. Like, there was nothing about him that actually seemed truly frightening, because he was so ridiculous looking.
The other people at the shelter pull Tom and pantsless man apart, and as Tom and Christine are making their exit, the scary guy is pointing at her and saying, "I know what's inside you."
Which I feel like you could take a couple different ways. Like, for sure, obviously, we all know that Christine's pregnant. You know, she's already said that, but also a little bit, you know, how if you were trying to say that somebody was evil or like a bad person, you're kind of like, you're a bad seed, like you have a bad heart, or like, I know what's inside you, like your thoughts or whatever. So I feel like you could take that a bunch of different ways, really. But obviously, you know, the most obvious thing is that she's carrying Wayne's baby.
So we cut back to the Garvey house, and Jill has something small in her hand that she goes and puts under the family Christmas tree. Amy's there and, you know,
doing her Amy self,
doing her Amy business. And
just eating, hanging out on the couch.
And Kevin comes around the corner and he's carrying a box of ornaments. And Kevin, being Kevin, he is obviously making a try here.
Trying so hard.
And Jill, being Jill, just says, "Those are grandpa's."
I know, wicked snotty. Which, I mean, really, truly, if I was Kevin, I'd have been like, yeah, ornaments are ornaments. We're going to go ahead and put, you know, decorate the tree. But Kevin's trying to be a nice guy, and he's all like, "Oh, when I come back later, I'll look for ours." But I think, too, this was the first, like, true indicator to me that they weren't in their house. Because when she says those are grandpa's, I don't know, to me, I was kind of like, well, why would grandpa's boxes of Christmas ornaments be in their house? So this was like a little like, huh? Like, what is this?
We had, from a previous episode, Kevin Garvey Sr. saying, "How's my house?"
But I feel like that's the kind of thing you say anytime you're like out of town or whatever, or away from your own house. Somebody's always like watching your house, you know? You're like, "How's my house? How's my..." how's the house plants? How's the lawn? Did you get the mail? Like that kind of stuff, you know? So I don't know, but I thought it was weird. Like, what reason would they have grandpa's ornament specifically, you know?
Yeah.
Because those are weird. That's something you would have like in the attic, you know, not like your suitcase of clothes that maybe they would just move over there, you know?
But rather than throw it in her face, he says, cool. He says, I'll look for the other box when I get home. Because he's got to, he can't spend all day with right then on this. And so he starts doing the time-honored tradition of unwinding Christmas tree lights. And then he starts asking Jill if she's heard from Tom, has a new number for Tom, knows his whereabouts, just very dad-type questions. And she takes it like a snotty teenager might and saying, stop copying me.
He says, you know, it's his right to want to know what's up with Tom. Like, it's a dad's right to want to know. So he definitely refers to himself most very clearly as dad and wanting to know what's up with him.
And Jill uses, and as one of Jill's retorts, she says, okay, dad, Jesus, something to that effect. And Amy uses that as an in to say,
she's like, speaking of Jesus.
Jesus is all the talk at school. Chief Garvey.
Which is kind of a bizarre comment. This is like quintessential Jill and Amy, really. Like the whole like, hey, we're just having like a totally normal dinner. Then let's go on this weird rant. And then it's like, hey, we're just talking about Tom. Hey, let's totally like manipulate you into this other conversation.
Right. It was very clearly Amy trying to upset the apple cart.
Yeah, no matter what he would have said back, you'd have been like, oh, speaking of children, like she would have said anything to just go ahead and move over to this conversation.
And so she says, Jesus is missing. And Kevin's like, yeah, what of it? And she wants to know if being city property, whether or not the city police are going to go looking for baby Jesus. And Kevin says, that's a big waste of our time.
Well, and he just quickly says, you know, we'll just buy another one. We'll just replace it. It's no big deal. Like, this isn't a thing.
And Jill looks super offended and says, that's cheating.
Which quickly gets Kevin's attention. And it's clear that he's like, uses his superior detective skills here and is like, hold up. Like, this seems like you two weasels are way more interested in this little prank then two teenage girls should really care about whether the town nativity scene is intact. So I thought he was pretty smart there. And he's like, Jill, did you take the baby Jesus?
And she dodges and says, that's sick.
And he's like, yeah, it is sick. But so what, you know, did you do it? They just ignore.
The typical Jill.
She's all, whatever.
Like, final argument is to run away.
Oh, yeah. Go to our room. Slam the door. Usual. And Amy gives him the like, you know, kind of like side look, snacking on her sandwich all sassy.
Well, he says, are you enjoying my sandwich? And she takes a couple more nibbles after after he says that with her eyes on him, coquettishly, I would add.
Exactly. Part of that, too, I feel like it's like that Michael Jackson memes where he's like eating the popcorn. She's like, and it's like, I'm just here for the comments. Like, she's like eating her sandwich. I go like, I'm just here for like the drama of this. And she's totally the one that brought it up. So she's just kind of a little evil Lolita Amy.
So we cut to the school parking lot where Kevin is going over tonight's strategy for police officer deployment, both in public and in hiding for what they expect to be the GR roundup of the week.
A little takedown. So I liked this very well. It sort of explained the first scene where, you know, that he had clearly gone to her and tried to ask her, don't come, knowing that that would just make them come all the more. So he had already planned on all of that. And this was really like a sting operation to go ahead and round them up for the holidays, maybe detain everybody for Christmas Day so that basically the town could just be in peace for at least a couple hours, if not longer.
But the mayor shows up and she waves him over. And she is on the phone taking kind of notes from one of her assistants. And it's clear that she's describing a baby doll. And she's writing down all of the description that you would need. And she instructs Kevin that, and I thought this part was weird, that the mayor, out of all the people she could get to do this job, that she needed the chief of police to go and buy a new doll for the nativity scene.
I think she saw the situation for what it was, which was that the doll needed to be back into the manger scene. And she also knew that it was sort of beyond reasonable to ask him to spend any amount of time actually looking for the original doll. So she wasn't necessarily saying, I want you to go buy a new doll. She was just saying, this needs to come to a close. Like, all the rumors and the hubbub of the baby Jesus being gone needs to end. It just needs to end. And so the fastest way we can do that, of not taking up any resources of the police or of everyone generally, is just go buy a new one, hustle it up, get the doll naked, scuff it up, and say you found it, and just have this be over. We just need this stuff like nipped in the bud already.
And Kevin agrees with me that he shouldn't be doing this. The mayor brings it back to the realm of believability by saying, Kevin, you need a win.
Which totally makes sense. This is like the PR world talking, where it's like, you know, generally it doesn't, this has nothing to do with anything except for public perception. And we just need the perception to be, you know, that simple things like this are going to be fixed quickly, quietly, without a big drama. And she just wants this done.
And this was a very interesting scene, given all of the interactions that we've seen between the chief and the mayor up to this point. You would believe that they do not like each other. And in fact, this would suggest that they do actually still hold, if not like, then at least still enough respect that they don't want to make each other look bad.
Yeah, I do think, I honestly think it's like professional respect. And I think it's exactly what I said about public relations. I think it's just that they realize how much of their job actually is just keeping the peace, even if it's just on the surface, even if it's just like everything looks quiet, everything appears to be in place, and it kind of doesn't matter how that all happens.
Right. She doesn't need a chief of police that can't.
Right. Can't even find a doll, a missing toy, essentially. You know, it just, and doesn't need the town to feel like they can't just have anything that just doesn't up and vanish all the time.
So we cut to Kevin at a nameless toy store, and he walks down the baby doll aisle, finds the exact baby doll that he needs, pulls it off the shelf, gives it a looking over.
Here's the thing on that front. Okay, so he pulls off the one that says it's a boy. And I feel like every single person knows that if you use a baby doll for like baby juice or whatever, they always use a girl. Because if it's a boy, there's some sort of genitalia involved or whatever, and they never do that. Okay, they never, ever do that. They always have like a unisex or like a girl baby doll there. So I thought it was a little funny that it said it's a boy on it. But for me, that moment in time had nothing to do with the Jesus doll and all that. It had everything to do with Tom. It had everything to do with looking down at this boy baby doll. And in a way, he was giving up finding the real doll by purchasing this doll. And I felt like in that moment, he looked at it and he said, you know what? No, like I'm going to find the original baby boy. And I honestly feel like that was all about him feeling like I'm not going to give up on Tom or that relationship.
I can go with you on that. I looked up Aforda, which is the name brand of the doll. I didn't find anything. There didn't seem to be any significance to that name. It wasn't an anagram to anything meaningful.
I kind of just thought it was generic, like kind of like Walmart brand, like great value. Like it's called Aforda. You know, it's like, this is like affordable, just generic. Like it's not even any, it's nothing special. You can find it on the shelf of any store, anywhere. It's not like they had to go order it online.
They didn't even get like a Cabbage Patch Jesus. They just got like, I mean, Joe's Jesus.
Well, or just like I said, just like, you know, the dollar store Jesus. Like you can just go down to the Big E, is what she says, and go get one. And so again, there's something about that that makes it seem so, like they could make it feel like that's so universal, that's so accessible, but somehow it's twisted to be like, it's so generic. It's so meaningless. There's nothing special about this doll. You can go buy one anywhere. Anybody can grab one. It's just nothing.
So he puts it back and we catch up with him in the car. And he's on the phone now.
And this is when he like actually reveals, like, you know what? We're not going to just replace that doll. And he tells Dennis we're going to start looking for this doll. And of
course, I want you to pull all the tapes from around the square.
Right, to see if anyone has any video of it from like the bank across the street. Dennis plays an awesome Barney Fife here because he's all like, well, is this like the priority now, Chief? Which is hysterical. Like, come on. Yes, finding a toy doll is not going to be the priority. And Kevin like totally reacts that way like, God, Dennis, like, no. But, and he says the line, I would like to stop dealing with the baby effing Jesus.
At which point his car just dies. He's able to pull it over to the side of the street safely, but the car's just
Does
dead.
It seem like that the brakes go out though? Because he has to pull like the emergency parking brake in order to get it to stop, which made me think actually that the brakes went out.
Well, cars are really hard to stop when, I mean, they're hard to steer and they're hard to stop when the engine stops running. Because there's a lot of assistance there. But the parking brake is mechanical. So it's actually your foot squeezing the brake pads. And as a former driver of a vehicle that exact model, it could just be that it's a Dodge.
Nice.
I guess he just catches his breath on the side of the road, and we cut to a hospital setting with Tom and Christine. It's very busy, looks like a emergency room.
Yeah, like a waiting room. But Tom is interacting with a guy who has a circle on his forehead, and it doesn't seem like Tom is like exactly wanting to engage with this guy, but the guy goes ahead and lets him know that the reason why they have this circle on their head, which kind of looks like a target, is or a bullseye, so that the creator can find them when he comes back. So basically there's some sort of other group of people who have this idea that they need to have these bullseyes on their head to be like their beacon for the creator to be able to nab them the next time he comes to take like a handful of humans off the earth.
If you remember, we saw the bullseye people smoking weed outside Heroes Day.
That's right, in the park.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they irritated Kevin because he's all like, come on, a little respect to your people. Like, the chief of police are walking by. At least put out your joint.
So Tom is sort of done with Christine's teenage shenanigans. It's his belief
her naivety, like the whole like acting like she doesn't know that she shouldn't have been cavorting with a weirdo.
He believes that
she sort of like amped it up with this guy, that by sort of interacting with him and maybe stringing him along with some amount of information or a little bit kind of being a little teasy with this guy or something, somehow she brought it on herself that this man put her in the spotlight. Had she just shut up, had their snack, you know, curled up with a blanket or a book or something, been cool, then, you know, the attention would not have been drawn to her. But because she's just like, hey, everybody, guess what? This is Wayne, blah, blah. And she kind of picked the weirdest guy in the room to go and like poke the bear, you know?
I'm sure he wasn't pantsless at the time.
But here's you say that. But the only thing is when he started coming at Christine, no one in that room was surprised that he was pantsless. What's a little bit like reveals like perhaps he has just been bebopping around bottomless there, because honestly there was no look on her face that was like, oh, I am seeing a nude man walking around, like not even a little. Like she was like, well, that's funny what he's saying, but like not like like no one like threw a blanket at him or something, you know.
So as I was saying, Tom is done, and so he gives Christine a little pep talk about her future behavior.
But I am not liking Tom's persona here. Like the interactions we had seen with him and Christine.
He doesn't want to get beat up anymore.
Well, yeah, okay, totally go with that. Being a woman, I do not have that idea of like being kind of like the woman who pokes another man and then my husband or protector or whatever has to step in on my behalf. So I don't really get it how a man would feel. Obviously, he doesn't want to keep getting beat on. But at the same time, I feel like the previous interactions we've seen with Christine and Tom, really the closest ones, were really out at the pool and hanging out with the gummy bears and joking about the reality TV shows. So now, watching him talk to her with this gross, creepo smile on his face and talking to her through his like clenched teeth, I found it, I mean, if I was Christine, I'd be like, get off of me. Like, I don't want to hear, not only do I not want to hear this pep talk, but you are turning into a really creepy character, and I am grossed out by you.
And Tom isn't hiding it well.
Oh no.
They are brought into an ultrasound room anyone that's had an ultrasound knows that you don't usually get it with a doctor, but this lady was the doctor.
Yeah, maybe because it's an emergency room and they're trying to look for like a specific injuries or something.
They pull up Christine's shirt and there's a pretty good bruise across her stomach.
Yeah.
And we also notice that Tom has fresh abrasions all over his knuckles.
Right.
And the doctor is dutifully suspicious of this whole thing.
In all honesty, like in any times that I've been at the hospital to have our children, they do actually ask you every time, like, are you in any type of domestic situation that you need to tell us about? They do that with like everybody. Apparently it's some sort of standard protocol these days to try to offer some sort of assistance to a woman anytime that their partner is like out of the room. They basically give this kind of like, here's information if you ever need it. So it's not surprising to me at all that when they act so shady, which they do, it's kind of stupid. If they just had said, we were, you know, sitting at this hostel, whatever, wherever they were at, we're at this rec room thing, and this man came bursting in with no pants on and started attacking her, I felt like the doctor would have been more receptive. But the way that they just told a little nugget of the story and just were like, a guy attacked her, and the doctor was like, what do you mean, like, where were you, what was, like, they didn't even tell the story very well.
Tom he's not as naive as Christine. He's seen enough of the world to know how this is going to go down, but he wasn't with it enough to come in with a story.
I feel like they could have told the truth. I really do. I feel like they could have said, even when the doctor says, well, did you call the police? My response would have been like, we were in a whole group of people. My job felt like was to get her to the hospital. I really assumed that one of the people around us would have called 911 or was dealing sort of with the attacker guy, because there was all these other people. I mean, if I'm like the first on the scene providing aid to the person who's hurt, I don't think it's my responsibility to call 911 to go get the attacker. I do feel like it's my job to get in the car and drive and get that person to safety. So if he had just explained even like one sentence, I feel like that whole situation could have been resolved, but he doesn't. So the doctor gives him a very kind of response and is like, I gotta go make a phone call, and goes ahead and like takes off.
Tom sees the situation for what it is, and Icky Tom still is brewing there, and he's yelling at Christine to get up, get ready. We need to go right this second. And Christine digs in her tiny bird heels.
Right?
And says,
oh no, hold up. Like, I would like to say, as a woman though, she saw an opportunity here. She realized that he was over a barrel, and this was the moment in time to press on him and say, oh, you want me to do something now? Okay, I'm going to need a little something from you. That was actually very strategic on her part.
She says, say it wasn't my fault.
Right. And we all kind of know, you know, hello. It was. I do think it was her fault in the way of like choosing to pick out the craziest dude in the place and start engaging him.
It was her fault to say anything about anything at all.
Right. But from the standpoint of ever being attacked, We have a solid line that, of course, anyone who's attacked for any reason does not deserve it, and it's not that person's fault. So I do feel like in that regard, she was taking just great offense to the idea, like, it doesn't matter what I said to this man. He had no right to come and choke my neck and stuff. I mean, she just wants that to be clear, and I think that that's fair. Tom gives her the creepo smile and I was all like, it's not your fault, but like totally being nasty. So he realizes like he's just got a hightail out of there, because now he's made so much of a ruckus that hospital staff has, you know, been alerted basically that like something's going on in that room, something's a little fishy. So
a chase scene ensues,
right, where security's going to chase him through the hospital
and he gets out.
Hey, and you know what, I give it to Tom, man, he has some good sense of direction, because he made about three turns and he made it right outside the building, which anyone who's in a hospital, even if you're following the proper signage and not in a heated run, you may get yourself turned around quite a bit. So I would like to say kudos to Tom for clearly being an excellent rat in a maze to get right out of there.
So we cut from a kind of a tense scene with snotty teenagers and a chase scene to the silliness of the Frost twins.
Right, our Prius boys are driving, giving us a little rap action.
Driving their beloved Prius. I don't know what the song is that they're rapping.
Sort of rap, but I love it that they're kind of like singing to each other. And we can see that there's a big truck pulling up behind them, flashing their lights.
The truck cuts them off, and Chief Garvey hops out. He's decided that with his Dodge Charger apparently down for the count, he's going to use the dog killer mobile as his ride.
Which I think is kind of crazy. I also had like a complete flashback to episode 3 when Matt Jameson gets cut off by the Jeep. Like the way that he kind of pulls up in front of them and cuts them off. It's like practically the same exact move. I did wonder for a second if somebody was going to attack them. But turns out Kevin just pops on out, gets over to their window and gives them the full on officer treatment.
He wants to know what they know about the baby Jesus. And he threatens to arrest them on related to the theft of the Jesus. And
co-conspirators to the baby Jesus.
And wants them to know that their plans for college might be jacked up on account of being arrested.
He pulls every adult card that he has for what would scare a teenage boy and does a brilliant job. So we go ahead and cut on over to the teenagers having a little
outdoors,
little s'mores time by the lake.
Little soiree.
Just having a little, joint and s'mores camp out time.
Right. Jill is helping baby Jesus toke up.
Yeah, that's sweet of her to include him like that.
And Amy is over on with the joke. She thinks the joke should be done and that Jill should just give the baby back.
Really know Biz like this. Like when she says to him, or I'm sorry, when she says to Jill, like, come on, he has enough on his plate. It's so weird. She seems so disingenuous that like part of me is like, she just wants to be able to go back to him and be like, hey, Kev, I got the baby Jesus back. Like she just like wants to have that moment or whatever, but it doesn't really, like, she does want to protect him, but, like, only for her own ends. Not because she's like, he deserves to be a happy chief of police. It just seems like she's like, I deserve to be the one to resolve situations so that Kevin can look at me as this, awesome woman. So, I don't know. I always kind of look at her with a little bit of a suspicious eye.
Jill's not buying it either.
Yeah, no, she's not into it. So she's all like, we're going to need some gasoline. And they totally do this like creepy biblical heckling of the baby Jesus where it's like putting him out on like a raft.
Well, Jill is arranging for the baby Jesus to go down in a Viking funeral.
Right. But it's so creepy because the people are like, the one boy's like, Lamb of Lamb, whatever. I mean, he's giving him like the whole really like, it just made me think of like the entire heckling of Jesus, maybe Pontius Pilate, I'm not sure who does it, but the whole like right before he's about to be crucified, just heckling him like endlessly.
Jill is the one who's going to launch the flaming
Nerf arrow
at the barge with the baby Jesus on it.
And see, like moments like this make me think like Amy's like so full of it because the kids start singing Silent Night.
And she's singing as well.
Yeah, and she sings along. So it's not like she's like, you guys, no. Like, I mean, she's right in there.
And as Jill is sighting up her shot, she decides she can't go through with it.
Which we fly on over to the Prius boys who actually start smiling a little. And honestly, this is the kind of stuff that makes me think of all of those teenagers that they are still the ones that are kind of the most normal humans that are still there in that teenage group because they don't want to see this. I mean, as silly as the whole thing sounds, I mean, lighting plastic on fire is like whatever. I mean, it's equivalent to lighting an empty water bottle on fire. But they have good enough hearts that they see the symbolism of the whole thing, that this baby doll was acting as the part of baby Jesus and they were being so cruel to it that it was just like they couldn't even take it.
Well, they're the ones that have some thread of what we consider to be present day normalcy still guiding what they do. They're the ones
they're
that
still just singing
when,
in their
when
car.
The chief threatens college,
right? They still care.
They respond,
right?
And right. The rapping in the car is
They're just kind of still kids, normal kids that we would expect.
It's the scene from Big with the best friends walking down the street with the shimmy shimmy Cocoa Puffs.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's what it makes me think of too. And plus too, I mean, of course, the other reason why, they're making that freaked out face is because if that baby doll does get burned up, they have been threatened by the chief of police that baby doll better show up safe and sound or else. So obviously now they're watching this potential threat come to life if they don't get that doll safe and sound back.
So we cut to a bus stop back in Amarillo. Tom is sitting there. He's got the yellow happy face phone from Wayne in his hand. And there are a pair of GR, local chapter GR watchers.
Looks like one of them had just got a little pleasant beating to the head because she's got a bandaged head up.
They offer Tom a pamphlet.
This is so mean.
It says, "Everything that matters about you is inside."
This feels like one of those like Mad Magazine things because he starts to unfold it like it's going to be one of those like fold the pages to make a picture. But
it's completely blank.
And, you know, Tom in his just like stress just kind of bursts out laughing a little. And he's like, clever, clever.
So he just scoots to the other side of the bench and starts really focusing in on the phone. The phone is going to make or break his decision of what to do within the next 10 minutes.
And he straight says, "I want to go home. I want to go home." And he's squeezing the phone and he's doing that thing that we've all done with inanimate objects where we feel like if we squeeze the plastic hard enough, perhaps we can send our will through it. And he's just begging for it to ring so that he can just get some answers to why he's doing this.
This is a test of Tom's faith. He's put his faith in Wayne, and the phone is his lifeline to Wayne. And he's saying, he's pleading, squeezing the phone, saying, "Tell me why."
And I realized, too, like when the bus actually pulls up, although I knew he was under the coverage of the bus stop there, I don't think I actually realized, maybe because of the time of night or whatever it seemed, I don't think I realized he was actually waiting for the bus to go home. Like, that didn't click.
Oh, like it was like, just a random
I thought he was just kind of sitting on like a park bench-ish kind of thing, but it was so at night that I guess I just thought he was just looking for some coverage, you know, from like the weather kind of thing, but whatever. So the bus pulls up. And of course, right after the GR gets on, the phone rings. And even as an audience member there, you're like, oh my God, what timing? Like, he's actually going to call right when he needs to call.
However, it is not Wayne.
That voice recording starts being all, "Have you lost someone? Did the events of October 14th affect your family?" Horrible. And Tom starts maniacally laughing at this point.
The bus driver wants to know, staying or going?
And, you know, he's just laughing because it's so absurd that, you know, here he is willing for this phone to ring. It actually rings. But then, of course, it has to be this just one more, I don't even know what to call it, like just poking the people who are still here left on Earth, the people that are trying to move on. And, of course, it has to be this recording that is just continuously getting under everyone's skin. And the bus driver asks if he's going to get on, and our camera pans to the other side. And it does, as a viewer, give you a moment to think, okay, as the bus pulls away, is he going to be sitting on the bench or isn't he? Did you think he was going to get on the bus, or did you think he was going to be sitting there when it pulled away?
On first viewing, I thought he'd get on the bus.
I really kind of did too. I really kind of thought that he was going to have had enough of this and it was going to be enough. When we watched it a second time, of course, I already knew, but still, funny enough, when the bus was there, I kind of felt like, you know, I still feel that same amount of like, I just don't know. This would really be a tough choice at this point.
Well, as a test of faith, even though it was sort of a failure that it wasn't Wayne on the phone, he did basically pass the threshold where he said, "I want this phone to ring right now, and I'll stay if it does."
That's true. And it
and it rang.
And it rang. So you're right. So maybe it did kind of just give him just enough to make him feel
that's
like
that's my guess. Still, that's how I felt.
I think that, and honestly, because the GR people were so nasty in that moment, by saying all that matters about you is inside this thing and there was nothing there, I think that it confronted his feeling of like, are you going to follow through? Do you matter? You know, are you really going to fulfill your promise? Do you even matter that you're on this earth? And I feel like if he had left in that moment, in a way, he would have given in to what they were kind of saying to him, that like, you don't matter that you're here. Your actions don't affect anything. And I feel like by choosing to stay, he was saying, no, I'm going to see this through and I do matter. And what I choose to do does affect the outcome. So the bus does pull away and we see Tom is still sitting there. So he did not go home.
The next shot is Kevin driving the dog killer mobile. And it's funny that I call it that because a dog runs out into the street and he dodges him. He does not hit the dog.
Which is super funny because, of course, in previous episodes, he's gotten out of his way to, you know, not only just kill dogs, but like track them down and shoot them and everything. So now a little bit we get this sense of like, okay, so he's back to a little bit of ordinary thinking about dogs. Like he would actually perhaps get into an accident just trying to save the life of a dog.
He walks up to his front porch and he finds Meg and Lori on the front porch waiting for him.
And they start to put out their cigarette and he says, you know, no, you know, you can smoke inside, and ask them if they would like to come in. I thought this was so sweet. Again, like the way that he acts like he's so excited in a puppy dog kind of way, that he's so happy that Lori would actually be there in the house, that he like rushes to go put together like this platter of cookies. And, you know, like as if he could envision in his mind that they are really all going to sit back and have coffee and eat dessert together for a while. It's sad in one way that he still has that much hope in his heart, you know, and he kind of shows even that he has like good hosting skills. You know, he's like, I need to go get beverages and I want to put out a platter of snacks. And he's not suspicious of them being there. He's hopeful of them being there. And it's painful for that.
His facial expressions through most of the exchange do express a certain hope.
Yeah.
And Meg is there as sort of a translator or something.
Yeah, that's a good way. Like interpreter, yeah. It's a weird thing. So Meg goes ahead and gives Lori a package, a manila envelope that Lori places on her own lap. And Meg starts reading this letter. And she's basically saying, you know, Kevin, I didn't want to just slip this letter under the door and run away. You deserve to look at my face while you hear this news.
You've been a great husband.
And immediately now Kevin's, okay, the like, oh, we were going to just have juice and cookies, starts kind of washing off of his face. And he says very nicely, please, you know, can you stop reading for a minute, Meg? I want to address my wife here.
There are all these little details that come in through this note, like Kevin fixed another man's mess and
took on Tom as his own son. Right. So you start to realize, okay, so when he married Lori, she was a single mom with Tom, and that, you know, that he did step in and acted as Tom's father fully and, you know, loved Lori. And he also reveals that, you know, that this is, she's not spoken to him in 6 months. This is what Kevin says. And that's the first time we get a little timeline of when Lori must have joined the GR, because in when we're watching this whole time, I guess I kind of was thinking like maybe she really had been gone this full 3 years, you know, right after the departure, but it's only been 6 months, which as a viewer, then that leaves me this big chunk of time of 2.5 years between when it happened to when Lori opted to join the GR. 2.5 years after the event, she opts to join the GR. That is fascinating to me. And I am super interested in, you know, more episodes and more reveals as to what was their life like, not just before the departure, but those 2.5 years from the departure to like when Lori said, you know what, like I'm out of here.
Before Kevin succeeds in getting Meg to stop talking, she does mention one more thing that I think is interesting, that Lori believes that she is possibly supposed to stay broken. Like she was broken, Kevin tried to fix her, and she's just better off staying broken. And I thought that was interesting admission or belief on Lori's part to put in this note, which is in preparation for the divorce papers that she has brought with her for Kevin to sign.
Yeah, Kevin grabs the envelope and rips it open, and it reveals that it is divorce papers. And he asks her real quick, you know, is this the GR that are they making you do this? She shakes her head no. And he, of course, grows more and more angry. And this was it was a difficult moment because he wanted to hear from her mouth that this was really her intention. And of course, this is so complicated because in order for her to express to him that she's 100% fully in with the GR and this is her new life, of course, part of that new life is she can't talk. And so he's saying, if you'll just say it out loud that you're fully invested in this other life and you're ready to leave me, then I'll like let this go and I'll let you go. But of course,
she won't say anything.
Well, she can't, because if she says something that goes against her new, it's like it's a good cop routine, right? It's like, when did you stop beating your wife? It's like there's no good answer. She can't say it to him to end it, because in talking that goes against the GR rules. And he's saying, if you're so into the rules, simply just tell me you are. And so obviously he's got her trapped there.
Before it can truly explode, Jill comes in behind Kevin and makes her way to the Christmas tree, grabs her little present, and gives it to her mom.
I thought it was telling, though, because once Lori saw Jill, she didn't just sit there calmly. She stood up and they looked at her, and she, both parents looked at Jill. And, you know, she has, this, Lori does react with her face the entire time, and she does show sadness that Jill has heard this exchange. And, you know, that was telling. I mean, because if she just sat there on the chair and didn't react at all that Jill came in, just sat there, sat back, you know, maybe ate a cookie or something, then it would be like, whatever, I truly don't care. But it's kind of like, you know, when you're caught and she just jumps up and is like, oh my God, like she cares what Jill thinks. She cares what Jill heard. And she does accept the present from Jill. And Jill, you know, as always, how does every Jill scene end? Stomping up the stairs to her bedroom. And Kevin, you know, says honey to Jill and is like heartbroken that Jill has now witnessed, you know, him getting so upset with Lori, which in a way makes me wonder, again, what happened 6 months ago. If Lori just slipped out in the night, did they have some big last battle fight or what? Because they seemed like guilty parents in that moment. Like, once again, we're fighting in front of our daughter, and now she's here again witnessing a terrible fight. And so it made me wonder how exactly that went down.
Kevin then makes his first step toward, if this is the way the future's going to be, then I'm picking sides and I'm picking Jill. Where we had seen in the first episode, Kevin say, please come home. In this episode, we say, please get out.
Yeah. He says, I think you should go to Lori. So that was actually, you're right. Like, he absolutely said, you know what, if this is the way it is, then I actively choose for you to leave the scene and I'm staying with our family here. So that we see Meg and Lori walking down the street, and you hear a dog barking in the distance, which is always our little, to me, it's like my Pavlov's dog bell. Like every single time I hear a dog barking in the distance, it's like eerie to me, because I guess it feels a little like we're being hunted or we're being watched or something.
And it's pretty clear. We've seen dogs around the manger. We've seen dogs running
in
front of Kevin's new truck. And so clearly Mapleton has what we call a dog problem.
A little dog infestation, if you will. And sometimes these dogs are cool and fine, and sometimes they're so not. So go figure. But
Lori opens up the little present. And inside of it,
well, right before she opens up the present, Meg looks at her and says, I didn't know you had a daughter. And that sort of prompts Lori to not respond, but to open the present, like as if to be like, oh, yeah, about that.
She opens it and there's a Zippo lighter inside with an engraving on it that says, don't forget me, which is heart-wrenching.
Super sad, because, I mean, okay, so as messed up as the GR is, here is Jill, who is a teenager, who put the thoughtfulness in to her mother's present. As messed up as her mother's new life is, and as much as she has abandoned Jill, Jill like went above and beyond and actually found a present that reflects her mother's new life, which as a mom, I can say that is just amazing to me. And you can see Meg's face. Like she is like, you know, wow. Like even she recognizes like this is a really, really thoughtful present.
However, in their new lifestyle, they're not allowed to have their own possessions. And Meg says, I think you should keep it. I won't tell if you do.
I feel like it was in that second that even if Lori had considered keeping the lighter, she kind of zapped back into her mentor role and kind of remembered that she was acting as a role model for Meg. And she has to now. It's like gauntlet thrown. Like she has to get rid of this lighter. She has to show that she has no ties to her past, because that's basically what she's been mentoring to Meg for all these weeks or months. We're not exactly sure how far we are. So she has to get rid of it. Like, she has to do a show of it.
In what appears to be a moment of just stark heartlessness, Lori takes the new lighter and just tosses it down a storm drain.
Here's the thing, though, that I would like to point out about this, because I watched that move like several times. She could have actually like thrown it, or even just really like hucked it anywhere or whatever. She actually places it between the storm grate things and it just kind of drops, which I think was kind of interesting, because it wasn't done with malice and it wasn't done in this like get away from me kind of way. It was like, I can't have this with me.
I know right where it's going to be when I want it later.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know if I want it later, but just sort of like this, like she just places it down, you know, into a place that she doesn't put it in a trash can, you know, like, or she doesn't just huck it into the darkness. You know, she kind of places it into the storm drain. We join back with Tom again, who has now entered the hospital. And this time we can see he has one of those bullseye marks on his forehead.
He's in disguise.
Very clever. I love this stuff when it's on TV shows or movies and the person just like puts on a different coat and everyone's like, where'd he go? Like, it's just like a complete mystery.
It's a two-part disguise. He's right. Taken off his shoes.
Again, what? The perpetrator had shoes, so this guy can't be him.
In the tradition of the ninja, he hides in plain sight.
Awesome. That's beautiful. I love that, Paul. So he gets into an elevator where a police officer there, which now, again, we can tell we're in Texas, right? Because he's like a sheriff. For those of you not in the South, it is not uncommon for us to see our police officers wear cowboy hats. That's a part of their uniform. But I recognize that we've yet to see Chief Garvey in a cowboy hat. So those of you who watch The Walking Dead, you may remember that Rick wears a cowboy hat as well. So clearly it's not a Texas thing. It's a Southern thing. But
don't you know you're in a hospital? when he notices that Tom is not wearing shoes.
Barefoot, which is pretty disgusting kind of anywhere you are. But he asks him, how did he end up like this? And it was kind of a sad moment there when Tom
is not a great liar. And I think that this line has a couple of meanings.
I do too.
The first one is that it wasn't a lie.
Right. So he asks, how did he end up like this? And he says, I was abandoned by my father.
We've been given enough of Tom's backstory to see that is probably close enough to the truth.
Absolutely. But we don't know.
I don't think he means Kevin in this case.
Well, but that's a curious part, because in all honesty, we don't know, because we don't know what has led to him being off with Wayne. So it's curious. Does he mean his birth father? Does he mean his father, meaning Kevin? Or again, he's got this bullseye on and he's been, in this other cult with Wayne. So does he mean Wayne? Does he mean he's been abandoned by Wayne? Does he mean he's been abandoned by God, Father? I don't know. So it was interesting. It was a many, many, many meaning answer, but also sad. It shut the police officer down. Even he was kind of like, oh, son, that's sad.
Tom finds Christine without any real trouble and commences to drawing a bullseye on her forehead.
It is very lucky that this is a hospital with like all glass windows into every patient's room.
In sort of the same way that the homeless in a big city don't really stand out as any certain individual. They just kind of are dismissed by those that are not homeless as being just kind of generically homeless. The bullseye that he draws on her forehead, he tells her, is to make her invisible. And I think it's in that exact same way. Just like, oh, you see a bullseye person in this future and you're like, well, they're all about the same.
Yeah. And obviously the bullseye also, clearly this group doesn't seem to be dangerous or a threat to anybody. It's just the kind of thing where you just kind of, your eyes just glaze right over them. So at the end, Tom looks at her and says, I promised I would protect you. And he says to her, leave your shoes. And the camera then does a close-up on bronzed baby shoes that are on a shelf and pulls back. And you see that we're now in Tom's room and Kevin is lying on the bed.
And he startles awake, like, where the heck am I?
Right. There's no sheets on the bed.
We look around the room and we see boxes with marker on them saying Tommy. And we see these are like moving boxes. And this room is just not put together at all. It is like like Caroline said, it's a bed without sheets. There's just these boxes, stuff kind of laying against the wall.
I was trying to figure out, like, is this like they moved his boxes back in post-college? Was this a situation where he never really had his room set up because he was gone to college? So this is some sort of indicator, again, that maybe this is not the house that they were always in. Or what was the deal? I think the thing that made me super sad is we've seen this in movies and books, but I mean, certainly people could relate to this in real life. When your child is gone, maybe for long periods of time, that you're particularly sad about. Maybe you are a divorced parent and they're spending a great deal of time away with the other parent or something. There is some amount of truth to going and sitting in your child's room, maybe sleeping in their bed, lying on their bed, something like that. Some amount you can tell that Kevin just wants to feel a connection to Tom. He really, really misses him at this point.
And he starts looking at his corkboard of old memories, family pictures.
And it has like all kinds of little memorabilia tacked up on it. And he sees a photo of himself with Tommy as a little boy on his shoulders doing a little piggyback type stuff.
And a new look comes over Kevin's face, and I interpreted that as a strengthening of his resolve.
I think so, right. Like he found that connection that he had been laying on that bed all night kind of looking for. He remembered their love for one another, and he unpins the picture off of the bulletin board and kind of takes it to look at it a little bit more closely. But when he does that, another picture falls out from behind. And at first, it just appears to be a picture of Lori when she's pregnant with Tom. But he unfolds the picture and it reveals another man, we can assume his birth father, sort of laying on Lori's legs. And you can look at it a couple different ways. And one way you can look at it in a good way, like Tommy put the picture of Kevin over the top of his birth father and, you know, sort of like as a replacement. But also, I guess I kind of took it as a certain amount of sadness, as if he was still hanging on hope. Like he didn't throw that picture away or anything. He was sort of silently hoping that dad would come back into the picture. He wasn't letting it go. So Kevin appears to have gotten ready for the day, and he's walking down the hallway and he kind of pokes his head into Jill's room, who's listening to some music. And he says, you know, hey, you know, how much did you hear the other night? And she says, just say it, effing Lori, just say it.
Effing say it, Lori.
Right. And Kevin, you know, pains, gives it like a little grimace, like, oh man, you know, she did hear it. And she's like, you know, why was she here? What was going on? And we can all appreciate this response because I really do appreciate it as a parent, because he didn't sell anybody out. He didn't sell Lori out. He didn't say anything nasty. He gave that parent kind of response that's trying to protect the kid, of like, it's complicated. You know, he didn't say, well, guess what? Your mom just showed up here like a jerk and she wants a divorce and I don't want one. Like, he really acted like an adult and a protector of Jill and of the relationship of Jill and her mom, and said, you know, it's complicated, and just try to leave it at that. And Jill, in her snarktastic Jill way,
she is not interested in half truths or even parent stock answers. And she says, let me know when it's simple.
And in all honesty, and like on the flip, I can totally appreciate that. Like, her response of it being like, well, life's complicated, you know, having to take that as some sort of actual answer, is like, their lives in the last 3 years are so chaotic and so crazy. And clearly we've been shown that there have been so many changes that it was sort of a duh, like, come on, dad, really? I mean, everything is going to have a complicated response.
So Kevin is drawn outside for some reason.
I think he's heading out for the day. I think he was just leaving. He opened the door to head out the front door.
And we hear some kind of commotion. And
this is adorable, the Prius boys.
The Frost twins are trying to make a getaway.
Doing the worst getaway ever. Epic fail getaway.
One of them is yelling, go, go. And then the other one just starts moving the car. But the first one isn't in the car yet.
So they're doing this like complete like Benny Hill, like, dun, 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 like circus, just running around trying to get in the car, trying to take off. And Kevin looks down on his feet, and what does he see but baby doll Jesus?
Jill comes down the stairs to see her dad holding the baby. And last time Jill saw the baby, he was adrift.
Right. And so Kevin looks up at her and says, found him, which is super clever, I think, actually, because he didn't spend all of his time actually going looking for him. He simply went to someone who he could threaten and was basically like, get that doll back or else. So that's some clever policing, really. He didn't spend even a moment of time looking for that doll. He just delegated that to the Prius boys.
In a world of lost and found, this baby is found.
That's right. Exactly. He did it.
So we cut to a bus where Tom is asleep and Christine, slow to learn,
befriends a stranger and starts blib-blabbing with her.
A soldier also named Tom.
Which I know Paul disagrees with me on this, but I found it weird of how much that the soldier looked like Tom, and the fact that he was also named Tom, and the soldier's like, how about we call you Tommy? I thought it was odd because, I mean, he was about the same age. He had really similar features to me as Tom, our Tom. And I don't know, I found it interesting. It struck me right away. So then the next scene really kind of solidified that for me.
The bus screeches to a stop and everybody gets off the bus to see what's going on. And this is a true, the first time I saw it, just a Lindelof, like, what am I seeing kind of moment.
It was. There appeared to be bodies strewn all over the road.
In these white body bags.
Yeah, they were wrapped up except for their faces. Most of them, their faces you could see. And it was super duper creepy. I didn't know what this would... I honestly thought these were maybe like embalmed bodies that perhaps maybe like they were doing some sort of... I couldn't even imagine because there's no reason for there to be like a mass
collection of bodies.
Burial or something. Right. Yeah, I don't know. So the soldier kind of warns Tom to be careful that some sad idiot paid a fortune just to bury that. And that's when we zoom in on the label and it says...
It's like a brand name called Loved Ones.
Right. And we sort of... Then all of the information we've been given up to now, that TV show ad that Matt Jameson's caretaker had been watching, the recording that Tom had just heard. You know, there was a bunch of indicators along the way about these loved ones things. So now it's clear these are some sort of replicate bodies of the people who have departed.
And so, Christine has made her way to the epicenter of the overturned tractor trailer.
Of bodies.
So she's walked over
all of these
50
all these
or so
bodies.
of these bodies, and she yells back at Tom
very excitedly, very like a small child to me.
Like she's put it all together, that she says they're all in white, just like the dream.
And so we remembered, we looked back in our notes and we saw that's what that weird pantsless dude had been saying. He had been saying that he saw her in the dream walking over the bodies of the dead and all in white. And this was, all these bodies were dressed in white. I have no idea what this actually means, except for that perhaps pantsless man now had these dreams, and the rest of what he said must, maybe we should actually listen to him because he had foreseen this part. So him acting so fearful of Wayne's baby and Christine now suddenly kind of shine a different light on that. Like, okay, this is... He saw all this and he is freaked out about her and he thinks she's like a bad person.
And I'm not convinced really that Christine hasn't shown a ton of mental ability up to this point. So for her to just put it together, just like 1 + 1 = 2 here, I'm not convinced that this is the true meaning. This is a convenient meaning to get this kind of squared away in this episode. But I'm not convinced that this is it.
I'll go with you because honestly, she was like so excitable and like happy that I mean, if that had been the case for me, if the man had sat there and told me, you know, you walk over the bodies of the dead, they're all in white, but then finished that off in a way that was like basically saying that I was evil and he knows what I'm carrying inside me and all this, that would freak me out, not make me happy that any of this had seemingly come true. And she seemed like, hey, Tom, like, check it out. And I don't know. She's such a weirdo, basically, though, too, because, you know, how many times has Tom said, like, stick close to me, don't give out a lot of information. And here's Monkey Face running off to, like, the furthest region. No one else had gone as far as she had gone. And she's yelling and carrying on. Hey, the dream's true. Like, Christine, this is a
traffic accident on a highway with stopped cars.
You're like, get out of the debris. Get over here. Quit yelling about a pantsless man's dream and like just shut up.
But Tom has no response. He is just weirded out and overwhelmed.
Absolutely. This scene is pretty disgusting. I mean, it really is. I was telling Paul that the one guy kind of a little bit reminds me of him, the way he was laying there and the way that they do look so lifelike. It really is disgusting. And I think also the sheer number of them, you know, the fact that there's just so many bodies just clumped all together. I think one of the reasons why the departure doesn't seem as real is because there aren't any bodies. So you don't have this huge mountain of dead bodies there. They're just gone. But when you see the representation of so many people being gone, it's jarring, I think, to see so many people and how haphazardly they're just laying all over the road. It's so disrespectful to the people who had passed that it's like scary. Like you would never want to see a human body treated that way.
We flash now, it's nighttime. Kevin is getting out of the dog killer truck and he leans back in and grabs baby Jesus. And he is on his way in to the dance at the school with baby Jesus.
Like it's his date. So the mayor's up on stage and she's giving her, you know, thank yous to people. And she sees Kevin coming from the back door and she's like, hey, you know, we got one more person to thank, Chief Garvey, come up on stage, you know, say hi to everybody. And we recognize, okay, this is the moment where he's going to get some accolades for finding baby Jesus. And, you know, she's kind of giving him this knowing look like, good for you. You got the baby. Let's have this moment.
And after the obligatory, if you drink, please call a cab that the chief of police is supposed to give, he acquiesces to what he thought was the overwhelming desire of all the townspeople to see baby Jesus returned safe and sound. And he shows baby Jesus to the crowd and says,
so cute. He's like, you guys missed this little guy.
I know you guys were all worried about this little guy, but we found him.
It's like stone silence. It's like feedback. Like
he gets a pity applause.
It's like this, like, which is like so depressing, right? Because here's Kevin, you know, he's thinking. But again, in the bigger picture of this whole show, I thought that it was an interesting symbolizing, like, anyone who's out there who's thinking that this is everybody's going to just be overjoyed if Jesus comes back and that's what we're all waiting around for this like second coming kind of thing. The lukewarm to like wah wah response is like, you know what? If you think that this is a simple, you know, there's a simple solution to make everybody smile and laugh and feel better, you're sadly mistaken. Like this, even that wouldn't make everyone feel better.
On my notes here for that whole thing, I wrote down just the word thud.
I thought it was like slow trombone, like all wah, wah. And he feels like crap. I mean, he just has to slink off the stage and go walking down the hallway. He doesn't stick around or anything for the dance. So he starts walking down the hall and who does he come upon? But our old friend Nora slumped up against some lockers sitting on the floor.
And they chat and it is clear that they've never chatted before.
Right. And in the background, they're playing this slow song, These Arms of Mine, which if you listen to the lyrics, that it's this song of longing, of wanting to find somebody to be with and sort of it being an unanswered longing.
Amongst the things that they discuss are...
They have a really actually kind of cute back and forth, you know, where you know, she's saying that she had gone to school here and Kevin's all like, I don't remember you. And she's like, well, because I'm much younger than you. And he like kind of guffaws because it's clear they're pretty close in age here. But it's cute. Like he's not going to call her out like, no, dude, like you look the same. Like he's going to just give it to her. Like, yes, you look very young. You're very young, Nora.
They are flirting a little bit.
I think so. Just
he's carrying baby Jesus just sort of like by the arm or something. And
it's kind of by the leg.
And she's like, what's up with the baby? And he's
all
goes,
like, it's not real.
It's a doll. And she goes, I figured.
Which is kind of hilarious because obviously he's like dangling it by the toe. So it'd be a little bizarre if it was a real baby. But basically, you know, she reveals that she had gone to school there with her husband, Doug. And
this was her locker and Doug's locker was just further down the same row.
But basically that she had just found out that her husband over all those years had cheated on her. And Kevin, I was really surprised about this. He really quickly revealed that he had cheated on his wife. Pretty sure this is the first time we ever heard anything about that. But also just that he just threw that right out there.
Well, it gives a little tiny context to that flash we saw in the first episode when Sam's mom in the bar asks him, where were you when it happened? And he says, I was cleaning out a gutter. But
clearly he was in bed.
But we have
somebody.
A flash of him in bed, right. Now we know, we don't know, but we have kind of, like I said, context to that flash that there was cheating in his relationship.
And I think Nora asks what any spouse would want to know, which is why did you cheat on your wife?
And he says, is there a good answer to that question?
I thought this was pretty telling because honestly, he did take a deep breath and the camera kind of pans out a little and you can see he's kind of shuffling his feet. And in a way, I guess it's a comforting answer to Nora because he doesn't say anything like, well, my wife was a jerk or she didn't spend enough time with me. Like didn't make it out like, well, because my wife is a bad person or anything like that. It was basically like, you know, there's really no good reason to cheat. And I think that's kind of what Nora needed to hear in a way, because she, as much as you want a solid reason, there was no accusation towards her that she had somehow forced him to cheat or that Kevin had even felt like he needed to cheat on his wife. So I don't know. I mean, I know maybe that's just a woman's.
So you're saying of all the answers that that you could give, including things like blaming the wife or I'm an insatiable sex machine, kind of like, I don't really know,
give. He didn't say, I don't really know. He said, is there a good answer to that? And I think for me, I read that as there's no answer you can ever give that excuses cheating ever. Like there's nothing I can say to you that is really a good enough reason to have cheated on my wife. And I think if I had been cheated on, I think that I would want to feel like there's nothing I could have done to possibly have kept my husband from cheating on me. Now, I mean, hey, listen up over there, Daily. There's going to be no good answer to cheating on your wife, okay? This wife is going to want some answers, and they're going to probably end very badly no matter what. But I can appreciate the concept that, again, he kind of shows that maturity that he did earlier with Jill. That's sort of like it's complicated or there's just no – it would be unfair to try to give a one-sentence response to why someone would cheat on their spouse. And I think that in a way that at least Nora seems to accept that.
She's not there to judge. And
she doesn't seem to be, or at least not judge Kevin.
And so – They go through all this and they introduce themselves at the end of their little chat.
Right, because
and they shake hands and they smile and there doesn't seem to be anything like, well,
she clearly doesn't think he's like a scum of the earth.
I'm not interested in knowing a cheater, so.
Right, I mean, it seems like it's fine, so that's all good. So Kevin steps outside and the pace definitely quickens. He's got baby Jesus still under his arm, flanking him like his partner in crime, right? And Dennis lets him know, you know, hey, the GR's here, but they've a little outsmarted us.
He believes that they're, you know, using his cop x-ray vision. He believes they're about five yards away from the perimeter of the school's actual property.
Right. And I love it. Like, I mean, I think in this day and age where we're all a little bit wary of the police in saying like our word versus anyone else's word, Kevin totally pulls that card and is like, you know what? I think to my eyes, they're right on school property.
It's our word against theirs.
And totally just says like, break them out. Let's go. Let's start arresting them.
And they do.
So there's kind of a scene of a lot of pushing people up against cars, roughing them up a little bit. And he's in charge of getting Big Mama Patty. So he's putting her back in the back of the wagon there. And he's saying, you know, hey, you know, thanks for not disappointing me. Thanks for, you know, not making this like a big waste of our time. And Patty breaks. She goes ahead and gives him a little smirkety smirk. And that leads him, his cop gut, to say,
where's everyone else?
Yeah, wait a minute. Like, there's not enough of you here. But as soon as she realizes that she smirks, he gets it. And now she's kind of being called out. Her smirk like wipes right off. Like she's like, like, whoops, I shouldn't have really done that. So Kevin's onto this, that like, where's the rest of this group? And it does make us as viewers realize, wow, this town could not have set up a better scenario for the GR. They have announced everyone in the town will be gone from their homes from this time to this time. And we're expecting a group of the GR to show up. So
the police are all centered in this one place.
We're all going to be there. Right. And it's like, wow, could you have said more clearly, our homes will be unoccupied and or unobserved by any police officials. So what comes next but flashing scenes of GR
members breaking and entering several homes, looking very menacing, carrying large...
mostly screwdrivers. Or like ice pick-y looking
things. Things that...
sharp-ended items.
Yeah.
Quiet items that if you were going to do damage to a human being, it wasn't going to be a gun or something like that. This was all sharp items, like you were going to go stab people in the head.
We see all of our favorite GR members.
Oh, yeah, they're all there.
Meg is, even though she's a pledge, she's being brought out on this operation. We see blonde hair glasses lady from the slushy incident earlier.
They're all there. They're all doing their thing. And so we start to see they seem to be taking pictures out of picture frames or in the case of Nora's house off of her refrigerator. And all I could think in my heart was, this is so cruel. They are taking, for most people, what is their last perhaps memories of their loved ones. They're taking all of the photographs of the people, of their families. And for both Paul and I, it harkened back to the idea of Patty saying there is no family, because it appeared like for some people, they were just taking every photograph they had, you know, off of the hallway walls and stuff like that. And like grossly enough, they weren't just like scooping up the picture frames and throwing them into the bag. They were meticulously taking them from the frames and then
replacing the frames where they found them.
So there was just like empty frames in their place, which again, it made me just want to throw up, because it was like they were taking their images and just vanishing them again, which for these people, I would think probably one of the biggest fears that these people would have
is forgetting what the departed looked like.
Well, and I was going to say having things taken from them, feeling like you turned your back or you left your house for a moment. That sense of being so vulnerable to being, what's the word I want to say? Like after a burglary, people describe over and over how they have this sense of being just completely
violated.
Yeah. And that their private space had been infiltrated by any outside party. It wouldn't have to be the GR, but just that once again, they have their back turned and their personal, most beloved things are taken from them again. I could not stop feeling how cruel this act was.
We're only a couple episodes away. This is in real time, let's call it 2 months from October to mid-December.
Right.
But it's only a couple episodes away from Heroes Day, where the mayor was firm in saying people are ready to feel better. Kevin saying they're ready to explode. Mm. And the GR was there in that episode to kind of light the flames. And this action is where I started to think of the GR's actions as being reminiscent of Fight Club and what they called Project Mayhem.
Which did just seem like causing chaos, right?
Right. If you recall from that movie, they were doing things like replacing the inserts from the back of airplane seats with...
yeah, like scary scenes of accidents, right, and plane accidents and stuff.
They were intentionally trying to piss people off.
Well, or just create the sense of being unsettled. And that's the thing. Like, it's not in your face. They don't bash the doors down. They don't completely turn the room over or vandalize anything. It's like insidious, you know, just taking small, meaningful things from you over and over and over again, whether it's your personal space by standing there and just doing the, like, I'm not touching you business, just staring at you, or in this case,
taking away your ability to move on.
Right. Perfectly said. Yes, that's exactly right. So they show Lori and they're all getting back in the van, and she says she's going to go ahead and walk home. And we immediately shoot back over to Kevin, who now is in a feverish race against time because his eyes are darting everywhere. He knows that he is going to find out that the rest of this group has done something horrible, and he has fallen into the trap of the GR, because where he thought he had baited them to come to the dance and that he was going to really do something great here and lock them all up for the holidays, instead, he has been the sitting duck. They were watching him, and they had taken all of his attention. And now the song in the background is playing, "I don't want anyone's bloodstains on my hands." And this just like says over and over again that the last thing he wants is for someone to have gotten hurt or to someone be left unprotected, because he didn't look ahead and realize that they were so capable of keeping his attention on one side, distracting him and causing a problem elsewhere.
When I heard that song, and I don't have this as a fully formed theory, just with all of the Jesus talk and context and bloodstains on the hands being this song, and now he's got baby Jesus in the truck with him, it reminded me of Stigmata, the bloodstains on the hands manifesting in someone so devout, I guess, that they are Christ-like. That's how that works, I believe. And I don't think Kevin's that person exactly.
Well, he doesn't want to be that person. I mean, he's saying, the song is like, I don't want to have these bloodstains in my hands. But I was taking it like a total another way. Like, he just doesn't want to be guilty of having left somebody unprotected, because he just didn't see this coming. He wasn't able to realize it was coming.
He doesn't see any GR people, but he does see...
He sees someone fooling around with the manger scene again, and he pulls up there and just stalks over there like, not again. This is not going to happen again.
But it's our friendly neighborhood reverend who is fresh out of places to keep his own baby Jesus. So he says, "I heard you were missing one, and I had a spare."
Which I think is super weird. I'm not really sure why you would have a spare baby Jesus hanging around.
We don't know any men of the cloth to ask.
I guess this is true.
They might have them just hanging from their garage like
oh,
we
shut
have.
Up. That's a little much.
Like we have lawn furniture.
That's a bit much. We're definitely not going to think that. But I mean, I don't know. It just seems a little weird. It seems like the church would have like their nativity scene. And
well, but
I
he doesn't
know,
have a church.
Whatever. So, Well, okay, good call. So maybe this is like, maybe this is the nativity scene set that they would have set up at the church maybe, and now it's not being in use. So, okay, that makes more sense. I'll go with that. I'm not going to go with that. Holy people have Jesus is hanging around all over the place. That's a little gruesome.
And it kind of jives with, in the Matt Jameson previous episode, the business where, to some extent, I think Matt either believes he is or wants to be the savior, like with the answering machine says, "Our savior, you reached our savior."
And so intrigued. So he, in his own way, was coming to save the day.
Yes.
By replacing the baby Jesus.
With his own spare savior.
That's awesome. Okay, very cool. I'll go with that. So now we flash to Lori, who's walking down the street, and we can recognize this scene that she's coming upon that same storm drain that she has dumped the lighter down. But now we see she's going to lay down on her belly in the middle of the dark against the white snow and start reaching, really, really straining and reaching for the lighter. And this is cut with scenes of Kevin driving along, continuously looking back over at baby Jesus, who's given him these eerie, soulless baby eyes. Like, I'm looking at you.
In another show, this would have been the way this was cut together.
Oh, yeah.
It made me think Kevin is about to drive over Lori.
I definitely thought that, because there was no way. In all honesty, she's laying flat against the road in a white outfit against the curb where there's white snowdrifts that are like pushed up against the curb. So her white outfit and everything, she's completely camouflaged. And I mean, again, why in the world would you think that there would be a person laying in the road? And the last time we saw him driving, he had jerked the wheel to get away from this dog. So it just felt like we were going to have this deja vu moment. He's going to jerk the wheel, totally splatter Lori all over the ground, which, hello, they're playing the "I don't want blood on my hands."
But that tension was all for some other reason. That was not the case.
I loved it. I thought they were totally leading us there. He had just had this blow up with Lori. Jill would have been on the stand being like, "The last time I saw my parents, they were fighting in the living room. And now my father has run over my mother." Like, hello, this looked pretty, pretty good, like we're going to a trial.
So Lori is reaching through the storm drain.
She's just straining. Her fingers are just...
She tries to pull it up, but those things are not movable by 100-pound women.
But I think that this is obviously super symbolic of her inability to let them go. But at the same time, she's like fighting against her own physical body to stretch and touch Jill's gift.
Like, and that's the best she can do. She can just kind of scrape her fingertip across the Zippo, but she can't grab it.
It's terrible. So that pretty much ends, and we go back to Kevin, who just keeps giving this really weary glance back at baby Jesus.
He's had enough of Jesus riding shotgun.
And this completely brought up every bit of all that, all those phrases. Jesus in the passenger seat, Jesus riding shotgun. I mean, I feel like as a Catholic, I've heard sermon after sermon about some concept of when you can no longer drive your own life, you need to like move to the side, and Jesus is in the passenger seat and he's just going to take the wheel for you. And so I thought that this funny little glance in between Kevin and baby Jesus just spoke volumes for me.
Well, Kevin
does not feel the same way
Kevin,
as we do.
Rejects baby Jesus and pulls over to the side of the road and unceremoniously
chucks
him
Jesus
out the window
into the snow
and drives off.
I felt like at the end of this episode, I felt like how I felt at the end of many Lost episodes, which was like, man, I wish I knew the Bible better, because I felt like there were so many scenes that if I had very good clarification of a specific Bible story, that I might be able to draw a direct line between what was going on in a modern day scene and what was going on in the Bible story.
It does seem to be a definite searching and non-acceptance of some kind of savior to help deal with what's going on.
Yeah, and part of it, like the theme seems to be the savior's missing. That continuously is the theme. And then you keep having these false starts. Like,
right, this isn't,
you know,
the savior.
Well, like, yeah, like Tom is sitting there thinking like that if Wayne is the savior, he's like, man, if only the savior would show up. And then he gets a call. We think it's the savior. And then like, false start. It's totally this recording. We think.
But he's not willing to give up on that savior,
right,
just yet. This is enough to get me through right now.
Right. It just keeps happening.
You're
over
on probation,
and over.
Wayne.
Right. You're on probation. But it just keeps happening where you have the character seeming to get so close to finding the savior, or at least getting some sense of closure, getting some sense of like, I did what I need to do. Like Kevin, you know, finally deciding to give in to this idea of arresting the GR. And then it's like all for naught. They still created this problem. So we have all of our characters getting so close to some sort of closure or some sort of answer. And then no, like it wasn't what you thought at all. So I thought that the theme ran really clearly through the entire episode. And that to me as a viewer is super satisfying when I feel like everybody's experiencing so much of the same in completely different ways. Even Jill, she doesn't choose to shoot the baby Jesus with the burning Nerf guns. It's like she can't complete the act. Nobody like gets that satisfying ending that they're sort of looking for, because they think that's going to be what's going to make them feel better. And in the end, it doesn't. Lori doesn't feel better after giving the divorce papers. Jill doesn't feel better after stealing baby Jesus. Tom doesn't feel better by trying to feel like he's reaching out for Wayne. And Kevin doesn't feel better when he finally feels like he's trying to take hold of the GR. Nobody gets this glorious moment of like, I got what I wanted, or I got what I needed out of it.
So going back to what you were saying about feeling like a Lost episode, I would definitely agree with that, in that this episode moved the plot a little and gave us a little background on some of the characters, but then introduced a gigantic question that it is not answering this episode. No way, no
how. But I will say this. I thought we actually got quite a bit of characterization. I really did. I think that we were given a huge glimpse into Lori, and that she has in no way given up her family. And the little nugget that has only been 6 months. That was a huge revelation for me. I really thought it had been 3 years.
When you have a character that isn't talking.
Yeah, to finally get a little information about what was their thinking and what are they doing, that's huge. I thought we got a lot of information actually about Kevin. I mean, the fact that he straight up admitted to cheating and he really wanted to rekindle everything with Lori. He was trying to keep things together with Tom and Jill. Like, everything was so in his face. You know, his baby boy was gone, just like the baby Jesus. You know, like, so many things were in his face. And well, I thought he played it all, for the most part, I thought he played it very well.
We don't know where the cheating is in the timeline.
True. It so totally couldn't. We maybe don't it wasn't know. Even on Lori.
We don't know if Lori left because she learned of the cheating. We don't know if Tom, maybe right, that was a contributing factor to Tom not coming home. Or maybe he's kept it to himself completely. We don't know any of that just yet.
It's exciting. I feel like we did get a lot of information. And to me, I feel like I love episodes where you are just looking for every little clue, the song, the writing on the wall, the little pamphlet from the GR, being in a different town, all the different little parts, learning about the Bullseye group, learning about, you know, different things. I feel like we were able to put a lot of pieces together of the puzzle to start seeing the bigger picture. Still lots of questions. Don't get me wrong. I got a million.
And that should do it for this episode.
We hope you enjoy it, and we hope you guys are trying to find your own clues as to what is going to bring some closure for these people.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.